May 22nd, 2009. It's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you. forget her. I can't see to get her off my mind. I thought I'd never miss her, but I found out somehow. I think about her almost all the time. The day she went away, I made myself a mess that I'd soon forget we'd ever met. But something good is wrong, 'cause I'm so blue, so lonely.
Hey, this is a Watt from Pedro Show, special remote edition here. Sorry, Jerry Lee had some. Who was got bumping on him? He had a. There was a bum rush on him. That was Problem Baby. We're going to hear that a little later. Yeah. Okay. That's Andy's boy Messiah. Who's Andy's moved up here from Kansas City, Missouri to Portland, Oregon, where we're doing the show. Special Watt for Peter show, remote. Special for a couple of reasons, not just not being in Pedro, but this ain't on my machine. This is here. The good folks at SiteWorks, Bill Jennings and Eric Dayton, and their company here has been streaming my show for, I think, 7-8 years now. And the great cats, and they came to the gig last night at Doug Fir. I should say who's with me here, Raul Morales.
Hey there, how you doing?
Tom Watson.
Hello.
The Missing Man. We've got three more gigs to go. Last night we played the Doug Fir Lounge in Portland here. It was a good gig. And Bill and Eric showed up. We conked at Eric's pad, and here we're in the offices right now by the Water Tower, which is an endearment for Mr. Lynn Johnson.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah.
Water Tower.
Water Tower. Although we start two legs. Two-legged Water Tower.
Two-legged. All right. And we started the show off with John Coltrane doing Come Rain or Come Shine. Because this town is kind of more a come rain one, but we have California weather here.
Much shine.
Much shine. Yesterday in Boise, we had much shine.
That's right.
Rain threatening Salt Lake City. I mean, we could go back and back. In fact, the last show we did was in Ogallala, Nebraska, one of the more west towns before you get to Colorado. And we had done a tour summary. After John Coltrane was Jerry Lee Lewis with I Forget to Remember to Forget.
Yeah. Yeah, which members, that means he's always okay. Just spilling the beans.
Right, and we were remembering back the tour. Of course, we only had come up to Omaha, Nebraska. We've done gigs since then. We did Denver.
Yeah.
Larimer Lounge. And then we did Salt Lake City, Bar Deluxe. And we did Boise Neurolux. And then last night, Doug Fir Lounge in Portland. So you guys want to talk about the first one was
Denver.
Larimer Lounge in Denver.
Yeah. Well, we rolled up to the Larimer Lounge, and it was...
First, we got Subway sandwich, because there's one right next to the tail. We stopped that tail.
Yesterday, you got to start there.
Troubled.
Yeah, well, there's a young lady with some tattoos. One of them said troubled. Another one, I think, said
hate.
Anyway, she was working at the Subway, and
she was preparing our chow.
Raul and I met her the evening before when we were eating there.
She wanted to give it all Tom's money.
And she was like, I asked them, like, hey, where's the main town? You know, how do we see some of the city? She's like, you don't want to see it. You don't want to stay. Get out. You know. Then she said she wanted to hop in the van and come with us. And I don't know. The tattoos, troubled and hate, were kind of.
She seemed like a nice lady, though. Well, because the next day, now they tell me this story. So when we go in there the next morning to bail for Denver, of course we got to get
more
big surprise. Yeah. I had to. Actually, the night before, I didn't have tuna. I tried the meatball marinara.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Listen back for the part.
We listened back for that one.
Yeah, you can hear it. You can relive that one. We relived it.
I have tuna. And she don't know, I don't think. I knew what she said to my men. So I said, I'm leaving town. And the looks that she glanced over at me with, because she wanted to get in the boat and bail. She obviously did not find Ogallala happening.
Well, she wanted out.
Now, the reason, one of the reasons we conked there was because, Tom, you have a neighbor.
Yeah, we have some family friends where I grew up that, in fact, the father passed away a couple of years ago, but we're still very close friends, and they have this big sign in their house says Ogallala, and it's because I don't have the complete story. He's not from there. They lived there for a period of time. It might have been work related why they were located there. But I've always wanted to stop there. You know, I like the name.
Probably an Indian. Oh, you found out they were a tribe.
Yeah, it was a offshoot from the Sioux Indian tribe that went a little bit further south from the Dakotas and
South Platte River.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, Ogallala.
So we get in the boat. We have to say goodbye to Madam Trouble.
Yeah.
It was Trouble tough, hate. But, you know, people come into your life and out. Maybe she'll return it back into our life one day. We make the jump to Denver, which wasn't too far, but on the way I called up, because it was, we still had another 1,000 miles before an oil change, but I thought, let's get it down. We don't have to do another one for the rest of the tour. So I called up and I found one on the way in a town called Brighton. On Broadway.
Brighton.
Yeah, it's funny about, you know, this is the New World, so let's name the towns after merry old England.
Brighton.
And even the street, right?
Bromley. Hello, Bromley.
And this was like some, Denver, like a lot of U.S. towns, is like expanding.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's some build the rusted out middle, but a lot of times just go out where they ain't built before and put strip stuff. Mall and track home, and that's what they're doing with Brighton.
That's right.
So I get the oil change. In fact, get this. I get a phone call yesterday, and it's a cat who changed my oil at Brighton Ford. Say, hey, Mike, things okay? I said, yeah, I'm in Portland.
Yeah.
I said, you like the job? Do you like how they treated you? I said, but you're the guy who treated me. You did good.
Yeah. With no there were no happy ending, though.
Right? No happy ending. What was a happy ending? The boat, like the tire didn't leave the hub.
Yeah,
you know, but remember that cat? He played drums for Joe Biza's Universal Congress. He told me about getting his, Jason, getting his can. Jason Kahn. Him getting his tires changed, and like one of the tires is ahead of him. And then all of a sudden there's the master of sparks. So, you know, he did great. So I get the oil change. We pull into Denver, a place called the Upper Larimer by the Five Points, a place I hadn't really played before. And an older building with a tin roof.
Seriously older town, right?
Right.
There.
And we're going to have to chase down a conch pantomime. And Tom said, well, good, because I haven't done that for a while, but you actually did one here, because we didn't know.
At Larimer,
right.
Well, I kind of just mentioned to the bartender, Jessica. Super nice lady who was working there. We were talking about the rug in the bar area, which looked more like leather, you know, just from all the beer and whatever, whatnot, fluids, spillage and compression.
Soakage.
Whatever brought in on the soles of people's shoes.
Right.
And I said jokingly, like, hey, can we sleep here on this floor, you know? And then she inquired, like, oh, you need a place to stay? And one thing led to another. And turned out to be perfect.
Yeah, very happy.
Very nice. Nice to do that.
But we're going to play this gig. We're there kind of early. We did the sound check with James. I chowed just a salad because I was still holding good from that tuna sandwich. And I went to go cock in the boat, and a band called The Dualistics played, opened up. And
which
they had
band? The Foot.
They had a drummer named Foot from Rose Hill Drive
Nate,
that we had played.
Actually, yeah. Nate is his name.
Nate Foot?
Well, Nate's his name. The Foot is his whatever.
He was denying the Foot.
He was?
Oh, he wasn't in the Foot?
I go to Tom, I was like, he had a nickname. We
called
him Nate.
Yeah, he wasn't using his nickname until we called, until I called
him. Oh.
And then that's what we called him from then on. Yeah. So he's
well, I remember
totally
what happened was a couple years ago, we did a year and a half ago, we did a New Year's show here in Boulder. Brian Schwartz, who manages Dinosaur, asked us to come and play with Rose Hill Drive. And that's where we met Foot.
Yeah.
We did all a band of gypsies or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, they played. I missed them. I was conked. And then Tom gets me to come out. And it's a Tuesday night in Denver. And it's packed.
Yeah.
And we played a good gig. It was a happening gig. Kind of weird, but there was a lot of room on the side of the stage.
Yeah,
you could tell it was an old building, and then they just extended it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Because it was more like a square, and they made it a rectangle. And so, yeah, there was a... Dude's behind my bass amp.
Yeah, you were like on a little catwalk out there.
Well, the front of the stage was like the right-hand corner.
Right, that's what it was. It was the right-hand corner.
Yeah.
And so people would go to the patio.
They're walking around you, checking out from behind, all the way around. You could do the whole, like, pirouette, you know, like on a little cake.
I did do some pirouette.
Like cake display.
It was a good gig, though. A sweaty gig. And then Jessica lets us come to her pad, conk there, and she's got wash machine.
Yeah.
Get to... wash the outfit.
We just throw our costume.
She brought some whiskey. We conked out. In the morning, we got to go early because it's 534 miles to Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
She cooks us up California eggs Benedict.
Yeah. Just
tomato, avocados, muffins.
Sauce. Sauce, the Hollandaise sauce from scratch.
That's pretty good. Happening.
Not
so,
bad.
Thank you, Jessica.
Yeah.
Truly. And so then we start driving north and... we let the navigator decide. What I usually do is Fort Collins, cut the corner to Laramie, US 287. But I listened to Dr. Nightmare, and he put us through Cheyenne. Stay on the interstate. So I don't know if it was faster or slower. But we get into Wyoming.
That's a long drive.
And then turn west at Cheyenne. The interesting thing I saw in Cheyenne was a sign, tiny little sign, but it was for the Sand Creek Massacre. Which I never noticed before.
Yeah.
Because everybody knows about Custer. I don't think they know about...
Sand Creek, the river ran red.
Yeah.
My grandfather or my father's grandfather or something...
Yeah.
On his deathbed, apparently, he was... these words that he was muttering, his last words, the story has it, like, you know, saying something.
Because
like
you have Indian people
and the
in
river,
your family,
yeah, it's Colorado
right?
people, but, you know, the river ran red, or the river ran blood red, something like this, or his words. I didn't think that's what he was talking
red
about.
Blood.
This, isn't it? Yeah.
Because it was a massacre on women and children. Anyway, we go west, and then Rollins. Oh, we got to talk about, because I think you're conked, because you're getting ready to take over the wheel. So Raul's up front with me. And the snow, I mean, this is like very warm outside, right? Wyoming.
Yeah.
And there's snow that is not melted.
On the ground, yeah.
Wyoming, the wind blows so hard, the sun can't even melt this stuff. It's like a permafrost. And then Rollins, we pull over to get Subway.
At the police station.
At the police
Subway, really? So there's Subway involved.
It was kind of like the police station. How many cops were there?
Yeah, that's a little congregation.
Luckily, we beat the line, man. It was coming out the hatch.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of folks. And Tom takes a wheel up to, like, almost the border to Evanston, past Green, Rock Springs and Green River. And Rock Springs, big town in the west for Wyoming. Don't only have very big towns. But my mom was born and was a little girl in Dines, Wyoming. And it's a ghost town. When ran out of coal, the company closed it. So her and her brother went and visited, and there's some stuff still in the ground, like
really?
Remnant. Yeah.
Like
So I take the wheel and we go into Utah, and there's a little rain come down, and we come down to town, Salt Lake City, to Bar Deluxe.
Mm-hmm. Right next to the tattoo.
I played right when it opened 4.5 years ago, right next to the tattoo, right? And we find out, and Charlie's there,
yeah.
Guy who's been doing my gig since his effort. We find out that the club's closing at the end of the month. Terrible.
Yeah, just because no bad turnout, people aren't going out.
Yeah, but we had a good turnout.
I don't know.
But it was turning into what? You told me the
Burlesque Club. Yeah, I guess it's real hot, you know, right now. This over Salt Lake thing.
Right, and the opening band was actually, we had the same sound man as 4.5 years ago when I was there with Second Man. You were with me, right?
I was there too.
And
Mike,
and he was in the opening band, and he was this one, but they were called the
Jingos.
Jingos, yeah, Jingos. Jingos stole my baby.
They were good. I think it was the bass player's band. That cat was from San Francisco.
Yeah.
Nice guy. And we played, and there's a weird stage thing. They had a pillar right up there.
Yeah.
Tom had to dance with a pillar.
Kind of wrap around it.
A little wrap around it.
To change my choreography a little bit.
Right. But it was a very happening gig, and we stayed with a former Pedro guy, Danny Don Dalton.
That's
He's
right.
He's a lawyer now, and I've been staying with him for years.
It's always a nice spot to stop. Yeah. You're very comfortable.
Now, someone at the gig gives me a card and says, we want to chow you in the morning. So I tell Don this. He brought some Budweiser beer, man. It was, I had to use the Stoli vodka he had to wash that taste. I'm no beer snob, you know. I like Pabst Blue Ribbon, but there's something about this Budweiser. So I conked, I wake up, crack of dawn. He starts cooking up chow, even though I told
waffles.
Him. Waffles and eggs, bacon.
Oh, you had to have a pre-breakfast kind of thing.
He's got a collection of these propaganda posters for U.S. war bonds during the First and Second War. It's kind of interesting. Yeah.
They're interesting, you know. These are parts of
history,
you know.
That's why he likes them. So he won a big case and had to leave.
Yeah.
So we bail out, almost left the front door open. Thank you. And we go to this, I asked the guys, you know, we already chatted. No, they're like, no, round two, Mike. So we go to the Tin Angel Cafe downtown, and some nice people. I think Robin and Jerry. From old punk rockers and stuff, and they're owner operators of this pad, and they make us up these omelets.
Yeah.
Or that broccolini.
Broccolini, yeah.
Mozzarella.
Mozzarella.
Really good stuff in it. I don't know if it tasted good.
Really good. And
quality.
And little salads. And so we're pretty stuffed up. And then we take I-15 north and on the way to Boise. Only about 4.5 hours. In Snowville, Tom took over. We've got an excellent deal on some imitation nitrous oxide tanks that are actually lighters.
Yeah.
$1.
Only $1.
Yeah, $1. With the fuel.
And a little tether.
Yeah, to make sure you don't lose the little tab. It's, yeah, the emergency.
That was a trip,
tab.
Huh? Was that a trip? And then there ain't no snow, but you can imagine what it's like in the winter, Snowville.
There was a nice little lawnmower. Remember the old...
Old
school.
I got a shot of it from there. Yeah, you got dragged by a car, and the wheels turned and actually did the blades.
Yeah,
right.
Little hamster wheel kind of thing.
Hamster wheel, and then the ejection.
Yeah, ejection handle.
That's when you fly it. So we get into Boise Neurolux. The field next to it is no longer a field. They put up some condo, and because of that, there's a curfew.
Yeah, it's a Ramada or something.
Right.
Like that.
Oh yeah, and flowed me out. I don't know what happened.
Sure.
I just kept it in the thing. I didn't really want to eat it. I haven't eaten it for years, but whatever. I think this guy owned a cab company. Something he was telling me. I don't know.
Okay.
Nice man, but you're old. I'm old. You know about it.
Yeah, it's what we do.
They look like Rolaids, which was a kind of unusual delivery system. We're going to play you some music from the opening band. I thought it was a sound check, but because of the curfew. Oh, yeah, I across the street, I ate some Dan Dan noodles at China Pan.
Yeah.
And my fortune cookie was, you will make someone proud. Did you chow there?
No.
I had some sizzling rice soup.
What was your fortune?
I will survive some hardships, I believe. Oh, I got it. Yeah, it's on my computer. I saved that one.
Yeah, great. You saved the fortune?
I always do. Yeah. I have a stack of these things.
Oh, wow.
These are for lyrics.
Yeah. Bunkwins are where they give you the number for the lotto.
Well, the one that I got that on one of my guitar pedals is, you love Chinese food.
Yeah. Phenomenal. Okay, so I go to Conk after that, and I think that the band is doing a sound check, but because of this curfew thing, they're actually doing their set, and you guys got to witness them. Yeah. I looked in the window for a sec, you know, and I thought, oh, they're going to do their song, and then I went to Conk. And I conked hard. I came out of a conk, and Tom got me up, and they played a long set. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about these guys, and then we'll play some music. Do you want to play music first?
Yeah, let's do a quick let's do a quick setup with theirs. They're a three-piece, two dudes and a lady.
From Boise.
From Boise, originally from Sun Valley, I believe, living in Boise. But they're
keyboards, guitar.
Almost impossible to describe this kind of music. You could go through each song and give a description, but as a whole, especially live, it's like confounding in a really great way. I loved it. It was really fun.
Yeah.
Trippy.
What, Raul?
The drummer was really awesome.
There was a steel drum, I know that.
Steel drums, yeah. Kind of had Tom set up around the kick drum so you can go any direction you wanted to.
Yeah. Taster.
Yeah, his taste.
He was on his side, right? Yeah. Blasting.
Yeah, he was.
Well, the drums.
Guitar was in between, middle. The and keyboard.
Drums and keyboard facing each other.
Right.
Kind of like a little, you know, badminton.
Yeah,
game
and
whatever.
She was the net.
Table tennis, yeah.
She was the net.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's listen to some.
Finn Riggins.
Finn Riggins here at Wild from Pedro Show.
My days were made for you. But you want them to be just. I'm down and I think you should too. It's getting so late. Can't seem to find escape from the sun. If the nothing's answered away. With my heart in evil arms, I don't mind if the love is gone. My days weren't made for you, but you want them to be just. We'll be right back.
Let's move to Alaska. They'll pay us to live there. We can run across the Bering Strait, find spices for families there, and run back across
from Pedro's show. Now, actually, that was Finn Riggins there, the last song we played. The first one we played was Problem Baby by Messiah Parra. And we heard Death to Hipsters by Steak Knife. Richard Meltzer just came. He lives in this town now, and he's a big hero of mine. It's an incredible trip for me. to get Tam on the Watt from Pedro show. But we got to finish up this gig report for my missing man, Tom and Raul. So, this gig, Boise gig, was pretty good. At first, dudes were sitting at tables.
Oh,
it was kind of table rock, right? Hey, Richard. So it was kind of a table. What we're doing is we're, because the last radio show went up to Omaha, Nebraska, and so we're trying to fill in the gigs from, it's Denver, Salt Lake, Boise, and Portland. We're up to Boise right now. So these people are sitting on in tables and stuff, and they came up. We got it going. I thought it was a happening gig.
Yeah, it was great. It was really
fun. Oh, I didn't say... there was a challenge to the Denver gig I didn't talk about, or we didn't fail to mention, was the air was thinner.
Yeah. And
the same thing happened with Salt Lake City. I think it's only 4,500 feet, but it was still, right? You got windy,
Ralph. I thought it was more of a factor for me in Salt Lake.
Right. Denver can be really hard. I mean, I had to really slow down.
You know, Ross, we weren't acclimated. We drove right in.
Very well. Dry, you know, you're like, you know, parched.
First half, I didn't notice it, but second half, I almost keeled over. But fuck, by the time you got enough, sounds really fucking happening, us chowing on the mic, right? I don't care. But the adrenaline kicked in when, yeah, it was better than Lancaster with that heavy humidity where the air just taunted you, stood 2 feet in front of you and said, "You will not breathe me. I will not go in your lung." Fucking shit. That was a hard gig.
Steam room here?
Yeah, it's kind of warm.
It gets it like here? This was like a couple weeks ago in Lancaster.
Right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, you said I had a macho thing going, so I'm trying to share
with you. I made it in a bad
way. In the best possible way.
Professional requirements.
Well, yeah, that's right. You said the times call for it. The people wanted that. The other young men. Or, yeah, the younger, the more young men. More younger. No, somatically I've worked this out. I've gotten less younger.
Right.
When I was more younger, right. So, okay, Boise. We can't get Bart and Steps. Now we trip her out. In fact, this is a song I heard on your radio show, Hip Cats from Hell. Richard had a show in the greater Los Angeles.
Huh? 105 years ago.
105 years ago when he was more young. And it was a Pacifica station, KPFK, and it was a great show. And he played this song, Bloody Hammer. You remember playing the Bloody Hammer?
Yeah.
Well, we go over to this pad. This lady was raised Mormon. Then she said she had a big thing. I'm going to make up my own life and decisions. And Tom starts rapping off because Tom's kind of just into... Although he's played with Mayo Thompson for 16 years, who was a contemporary of Rockies.
Yeah.
He's just getting into his work, so I'm playing it in the boat. I have hundreds of his tunes. And he starts reeling off the lyrics to the Bloody Hammer to this lady, and it's blowing her mind. And,
Baby Ghost says, take your Jane away.
That's all. And, you know, there's a documentary on his life. Yeah. Yeah. I met his brother, yeah. Summer. He was in Pittsburgh for a while. Henry bought him new teeth. Oh, see, Henry does good shit. Put out a book of his lyrics called Openers 2.
I have a good friend who's older than me and needs teeth, but I can't afford to buy it.
No, maybe you can call Hank.
Right.
But that, supposedly this helped a lot. He could sing again better. And
yeah.
I seen him twice in the last year. He played in fact, from a Stooges gig, we got landed in Chicago. I went right from the airport, and he was on the Game Boy stage of Lollapalooza. Yeah, this is these days, right? The Game Boy stage. He's got Rocky Erickson singing, Cold Night. He started off with Cold Night for Alligators.
I saw Rocky play. I actually saw him at a little tiny press party in 1976.
Whoa.
In L.A. And
was that the Harvey record yet? Interpreter and...
I really don't remember.
Bermuda was the other side.
Okay. But it was like they were in like jackets and ties. And, I mean, it was something very genteel.
Wow.
It seemed very not spaced, you know?
Yeah,
it seemed
yeah.
Like, it was just a small little party. And maybe 77, one of those years. And that's where Greg Turner asks him, he says, "Oh, you heard the Sex Pistols, Rocky?" Oh, yeah, and they're terrific. He says, what's your favorite Sex Pistols song?
Hot cars. Yeah. There's a recording to this.
Right.
Right. Yeah, Hot Cars.
Which is a Buzzcocks song, or Fast Cars.
Yeah.
I've heard that. What a trip. That's Greg Turner, huh?
Yeah.
Is he still teaching
Greg Turner,
that?
Greg Turner is capable of fibs.
Oh, okay.
So who knows? But this is a good story. It's believable.
He's teaching calculus in Albuquerque or something.
Somewhere like that, yeah.
Was he teaching back then? Something in Montclair or Claremont? What's the deal with that? Claremont and Montclair. What the, is this like kind of a...
inversion.
No, or just to illustrate the human dilemma, how the motherfuckers... we're not going to call it Claremont, we're calling it Montclair. You know, probably there was no difference.
Right.
What's it mean? Clear Mountain?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mountain Clear. I played both those places because there's colleges, four or five colleges, and JPL and Caltech, stuff like that, and some private schools. In fact, the Green Door was the club, and now it's a parking lot for mall. It's really horrible. People, it's Derry's, Altadena, and all that. Right. It's track home now.
Right.
People make the 3-hour hell ride.
You could own a horse. And ride a horse on the street in Altadena. I don't know if not in Pasadena. I don't know if it's still true.
Wow. I know Sierra Madre has the only volunteer fire department. Because the only fire department wouldn't go up those little canyon roads. So they had to make a volunteer. Remember the movie? Bogey?
Yeah.
He dies. The greed, the money's blowing. I think Walter Giles, the only time father and son gets Oscars. But that's the badges. That's where we get this Minutemen song, right? Where's your badges?
Right.
Badges.
But the town of Sierra Madre is where they filmed the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Really?
Yeah. It's where all the locations were.
That was a creepy movie. The pods.
Yeah.
They remade that, right? And they used that guy at the beginning.
Kevin McCarthy.
Like some psycho scene.
Yeah.
Maybe he gets hit by a car or something after he says something, but it's like it's some kind of continuity.
He's yelling something like, here they are.
Yeah, right,
oh,
right.
Oh.
Yeah.
I remember the pods that were foaming.
Yeah.
Scary, creepy. Not the eye candy of today movies, but still pretty creepy.
Right.
Creepier.
But what's the psychology of that stuff in the 50s? All that paranoia because of the missiles and the bombs.
Nuclear.
More than that, there's the horrible, godless commies.
Yeah.
You know,
they're like
wherever you look, maybe somebody in your family is a commie.
That's right.
It might look normal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Rocky's got a song like that, The Creature with the Atom Brain. In fact, he's reading from a movie.
Right.
You're Buchanan? I'm not Buchanan.
That was a movie. Yeah. I saw that when I was 9 years old or something. There's a double feature with It Came from Beneath the Sea.
Wow.
Which Came from Beneath the Sea has a giant octopus
wraps
its tentacles around the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And the creature with the Atom Brain wasn't so hot.
Yeah.
But it drove him to write a song.
Right.
And it's kind of intense. That I remember that record. It came out in England and had the most intense cover. Like his head was blowing up and the dog was jumping out or something. And it had the name of it was in letters. Okay, from Boise, we could call it with Bart. He made his homemade pizza for the nighttime. He wanted to make his breakfast chow, but I get us out. We leave a nice note. Then we drive over the Cascades to Portland, which is here. Where did I give you the wheel? Pendleton. Yeah, outside. I get us over the... That can be hell if you come at the wrong time of the year. In fact, I got stuck in LeGrand.
That's a big range you're coming.
See, but you got to understand, Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, nothing like the western parts of their states. There's this thing called rain shadow, and they're like desert. So completely different. There's no fir trees, nothing.
Except Pendleton is where they make the shirts.
That's right. That's where it starts turning into the Oregon everyone knows. And you go along the Columbia River. That's where you turn west, really, because before that you go north.
up to the river. It's easier than trying to get over those mountains. There's a couple roads that do it, but
that's a nice drive along the river too.
It is.
It's a
really big river.
Yeah.
When we turn west, there's several dams on it. Even they said
many.
But you know they fouled it. They tried to reenact this Lewis and Clark thing, and they had to stop. And it was embarrassing. They had that National Geographic cameras on this pollution. They had to stop the trip. But right across where we turned west and go along the rivers across in Washington, there's a lot of states like to do this to their beloved neighbor. You put the hell shit right on the border. And there's Hanford.
Right.
It's just like Hanford's where you put used nuclear submarine bodies
that
will be radiated from it. That's vats of shit. That, in fact, workers during the Cold War and shit, you know, it was a what they call them Russian towns, they're like closed cities and stuff.
Well, it used to be the theory, and it's probably true, was that Hanford, when they were doing building bombs there and all that, was they let it go for as long as they could just to get statistics on how radiation was affecting everything within a circle of, you know, so many miles.
Yeah, yeah.
They just wanted to, you know, use the population as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
To just see what they could get away with.
Gotta know.
Well, they had high school there. And of course, the team was called the Bombers.
Yeah.
And the mascot was a mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
the Kubrick thing, you know, just give in to it.
Yeah.
Just give in, man.
Yeah, love it.
What's his name? Sellers got two roles. He's an England guy.
Claire Quilty. No, that was some sort of
Mandrake.
Mandrake. Yeah, that's right. Mandrake.
Right, Branchwater and Great Hill College.
And he was
Doctor Hayden.
Yeah, Mash. And then he's Doug.
Yeah, he's on the
But Sterling Hayden, you know, played that guy.
Yeah, the gun. Yeah,
shot
he's
himself.
Great.
You know, he was an actual commie. He was a guy who was a full
blacklist.
He wasn't blacklisted because he turned other people in.
Right.
He was in a couple of Kubrick films. That's all that.
Right. He's also in The Killing.
The Killing. Yeah, he's good in that.
Right.
Tough guy.
Yeah.
The Killing. So we get here in town kind of early. The new pad I've never played called Doug Fir Lodge. It's got a restaurant and a hotel. And we're kind of in the basement. And all the, what do you call it, motif is log cabin. And Richard comes and I get to meet you and your new wife.
Yeah.
Well, only wife.
The lovely Jessica.
Right. Much respect to Jessica, who's a Montana lady. And has come to the big city to share a life with Richard.
Yeah.
Well, she didn't come. She's been here.
But she lived on a reservation in a double wide.
It's like I always wanted, you know, what is a reservation? Does it have a fence around it? No, it's just a big, it's like one of the biggest reservations in Montana. And there are more white-owned ranches, farm property on the reservation than there is...
Indian land.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's all called the res.
That means it's good land.
Oh, yeah.
Now, stuff like the Navajo one, which is, I think, the biggest reservation, I mean, it's on the desert. Or not like the stuff in New Mexico where they use radiated Los Alamos to do the roads.
Yeah.
Probably got a lot of white owned farm there. I wonder, you asked what it was like living there. So it was kind of.
Well,
she saw some Indians or Native.
Oh yeah, you know, you'd see them all over.
Okay.
But they weren't the dominant property owners.
Right, right.
You know, they were.
That is a trip.
Yeah. You know, they had some political control over things, but they were poor and beat down.
Yeah. Maybe casino. Maybe casino work.
Jessica's father teaches psychology at an Indian school, Indian college that's on the reservation. And he's got to deal with people who just, you know, beat down.
Beat down, broke,
yeah.
I've seen it at other places too in Australia.
Yeah.
Aboriginal people. That's funny too, because, you know, we got to get back at the core value, the core people, the core of the old, good old days.
Whenever that was.
Yeah. When it
before the advent of man.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Still dinosaur.
Right.
Pterodactyl times.
Right. I like the notion where you come up with this intelligent design.
Oh, yeah, all right. Get around.
What's intelligent about the man, you know?
The ascent of man. Yeah. We got a euphemism for pterodactyl. Yeah. Yeah, Lucky Pierre. Okay. Socket Man, yeah. Troy, we got a lot of time to think about this. But we're at the end of the first hour of May 22nd, 2009, Wow for Pedro show. Hold tight for hour two. May 22nd, 2009.
Good to see you, man.
It's the second hour. Yeah. The Wild from Pedro show.
Yeah.
And got guest of, well, not guest, he lives here. I'm the guest in Portland, Oregon. Richard Meltzer, and you're going to tell an old Hollywood story.
Yeah,
when you lived on Detroit?
Yeah, right. 343 South Detroit, off of parallel to La Brea.
Yeah, near Pink's.
Right.
When there used to be no line at Pink's, you could chow there easy.
Right.
There was a big black guy named Johnny serving them up.
Yeah.
I found out about Pink's because of Blackie's, which was down the street.
Right.
Where I saw Angry Samoans play with the Dills and things like
that. Right.
Weird club.
Blackie's, yeah.
I don't know what the story on that was, but a lot of those clubs were like that in those days.
Yeah, I think I saw Wall of Voodoo and Black Randy there once.
Yeah.
And Black Randy had like a dancing girls that night.
That stage?
Black X or whatever he was calling them.
You guys on?
Yeah, and that tiny stage, huh?
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
But
that was a stumbling distance from your pad. Not too far.
Right.
Only a few bucks. Yeah.
Right. But basically, I stopped going to shows somewhere in the 80s. I remember you go to the shows and the audience, they just, a bunch of louts would come up from Orange County and trash the club.
Yeah.
You know? And when the clubs wouldn't have the bands would play like a loft somewhere. The same louts would come and trash the loft, you know?
Yeah.
And it just got so unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah. But do you have good memories of shows in the 70s?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, those are just, you know, years of delight.
So much different than arena rock.
Yeah.
Well, right.
Arena rock.
The Nuremberg Rally.
Do you just play arenas?
Often festivals.
Yeah.
Really strange, because they were a club band. And I was going to ask you about the 60s, was an era of clubs.
Yeah.
See, my first gig is T-Rex at 1971. I know nothing about clubs until punk.
Right, clubs. The thing is, New York, I lived in New York till 75, and New York had most of the clubs were like mob-controlled and you know, minimum drink, you had two drinks and you know, that kind of thing. Sit down kind of places.
Oh.
And I saw the MC5 at a place called Ungano's, 1971.
So just play, I've heard plenty of stories of them playing there.
Yeah. But it was like the first time I ever saw anybody play an arena, Rolling Stones at Madison Square Garden in 1969.
Yeah.
And it was just a strange, you know, just too big a place.
Yeah, right.
I saw the Beatles at Shea Stadium, but that was, you know, an anomaly.
What was that like?
Yeah, it was terrific. It was like,
I mean, the sound, though. Was it tiny?
You couldn't hear anything. It was like, and they did 2 years in a row. It was first the summer of 65, and the show started like, I don't know, 8 o'clock or something. And the seats were full by 4 p.m. Everybody wanted to be there to see the Beatles arrive.
Wow.
It was just a very religious experience.
Yeah.
And every time a helicopter would go around, oh, that must be them. And they finally arrived in a Brinks truck that came in through the outfield. And everybody, and when finally you saw them, everybody, like 56,000 people, just stood up in awe. You know, and the music was still 3 hours away, you know.
Oh, wow.
And it was.
How long did they play?
They played no more than half an hour. And, you know, and I think opening for them, maybe Cannibal and the Headhunters, and Bobby Hebb singing, what's that song? Sunny. Oh. Da, 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 you know, right? And then the Beatles come on, and you couldn't hear anything. They didn't have the sound figured out for those kind of rooms yet.
Yeah, rooms.
And couldn't hear anything. And you could sort of make out what the song was, but you couldn't hear it.
Wow.
You know.
Were people yelling?
Oh, everybody. Yeah. Everybody was just standing up like it was a religious event, you know.
How much was it? Was it big money?
Well, it was like, I think it cost $15, which was a lot then.
Yeah.
And I think the deal was that it was...
T-Rex for me was $250.
$250. Right.
A lot of those gigs were really cheap.
You mean 2.5.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the Cal Jam was $650. They're trying to sell records, so the concerts wasn't in... no merchandise.
Right, but the reason it was $15, it was ordinarily maybe a $5 ticket. Cerebral palsy bought up a bunch of tickets, so you would pay the extra amount to cerebral palsy.
For like a charity.
Yeah. Right.
How strange.
Right.
So that's the first arena.
I mean, that's
right.
That's like scalping. You know, why should cerebral palsy be allowed to scalp? What they do. You know?
So that was the first Stadium Rock.
And then I saw the Stones.
Then
you know,
Stones
like
in 69.
4 years later, whatever it was. And I had a chance to see the Doors at Madison Square Garden. I refused. I'd seen them in clubs. I saw them play in...
Is that the live album?
Some of the stuff is taken from that. But I saw them play 30 or 40 times in a little club called Ondine's. It was underneath the 59th Street Bridge. It was like a disco frat boy kind of place. And I think Barbara Springfield played there, and then the Doors played there.
Wow.
And
you saw them a lot there.
And that's when I was starting to write, and you could get into shows free. And I thought, wow, I was writing for Crawdaddy.
Yeah.
So it was like, real service trade to be in a band. You just played until 4 o'clock, 4 a.m. closing time. They would just play set after set after set until every, you know.
Keep people drinking.
Yeah, for about 3 months they played. So I saw them about 40 times. And Morrison didn't even have leathers yet. He wore jeans and a surfer shirt. And they were just terrific. I remember the first night they played, I was with these other people from Crawdaddy. And after one set, we say, is that the greatest thing ever, or is that the greatest thing ever? We were just blown away. That was after the first set, and they played another 3-4 sets. You know,
wow.
And they did one set. They started with People Are Strange, and they finished with People Are Strange. They did a 45-minute version of the end.
Wow.
Just improvised lyrics and everything, right. And Jim was like, masturbating one of the nights, through his pants.
Because from the live record, you think there was an animosity to New York,
right?
With them, huh?
Maybe so. I mean, I didn't go to that show, but there was a...
Maybe by that time, that's down the road, too.
Right. But after a while, I think maybe I went to a Blue Oyster Cult show at Madison Square Garden. They were, maybe who else would have played? It was somebody like Humble Pie, Blue Oyster Cult, and something else. And it was just a horrible place to be.
Right.
You know? And then maybe I saw a show once at Anaheim Stadium, Blue Oyster Cult, and some, seven other bands.
ZZ Top.
Yeah,
I think I saw that.
It was awful.
Is that Anaheim Stadium, Angel Stadium? Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah. But, I just stopped. I never...
Dirt bath in the infield.
Right. Yeah.
And he says something about somebody threw up a little joint. All right, this is New York. Or why are the guys rushing the stage or something?
Right.
And then at the end, it's really weird. The MC is like, take the escalator trip, the light trip. That's a weird record.
Right.
I remember hearing that as a kid and was like, is this a big put on?
Right.
I didn't know what about it.
Yeah.
I liked them, though. I didn't realize they were LA band. I didn't know about anything about where people came from as bands.
And all, when I got to know the Bay Area bands, they all hated the Doors.
They hated him.
Like Big Brother and the whole company. Peter Albin was their bass player. He's a guy, he was a folkie with Jerry Garcia in Palo Alto. And you say, oh, the Doors, ooh. And Love. They hated Love. Any LA band.
Wow.
And the only LA, but Stephen Stills was the kind of like their idea of a fine LA musician.
Oh. Birds.
Right.
I think a lot of people got into the Birds.
Well, not the Birds. He was with Buffalo Springfield.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, Crosby and Stephen Stills were the two L.A. connected people at the Bay Area. They did a lot of drugs with those two guys. And so...
In fact, Stills, I heard, ended up playing all the bass on those Crosby, Stills, Nash records. I heard it in person. You're not a very nice man.
He was not.
Yeah. David Crosby, I was at a chow thing, didn't say one word, just hard look.
I went to a show in Montreal about 74, 75. Stills had a wife, Véronique Sanson, you know, chanteuse from Paris.
Yeah.
And so they did a show. She got to do a show in Montreal, an outdoor show, summertime outdoor show, with the Villemard Blues Band. They were the 17-piece Grateful Dead of Quebec. Three bass players, three female backup singers, you know. And it was in the days when you call them chick singers, you know. And so anyway, she played with them backing her up, and then they just jammed for like 100 hours. And Stephen Stills was working around. And what I heard happen was, before the show, they all had dinner together, and Stephen didn't allow her to speak French around the house. So she was very happy to talk in French with
the band.
They had a guy, Bill Gagnon, who was the he was like the Jerry Garcia of that band. And so at some point after they had dinner, Stephen Stills goes up and grabs Bill Gagnon by the collar and says, "Don't you ever speak in French to my wife again." And he was just furious with the whole night. He was walking around crazy,
stammering.
Yeah.
In the hell of a rage.
Right.
Panties bunched up.
Right. But anyway, you know, in 75, I ended up in LA. It was
right.
It was a kind of, well, I gotta leave New York, so I went to LA.
In that club scene.
Yeah.
Roddy Bingenheimer.
Right.
And the Stooges, it's their last days.
Right. But I remember that when the Angry Samoans were doing this anti-Rodney
campaign. Oh, yeah. That was heavy.
And it was like, I felt sorry for Rodney for a while. But then I went to some show. I guess it was a Starwood where he was
DJing.
Right. And then I was going to go talk to Rodney and say, I feel bad, you know, blah, blah, blah. And what is Rodney playing? He's playing a bunch of Monkees songs. And he's saying, I fuck Rodney.
He was in
a disaster for him. Yeah.
Did you see this movie about him?
Right.
Kind of. I feel bad for Rodney in that movie.
Right, where Kim Fowley has to assert his, you know, regal status. I'm the king. Rodney, you're the prince. I'm the king.
I did this thing with the Stooges in Randall Island where Kim Fowley was the MC.
Oh.
All these bands like Creation and stuff.
Right. Is that the one where they had, Handsome Dick Manitoba playing with the MC, with the remnants of the MC.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they had, but everybody got like three songs. It was a review thing.
And
a lot
and
of
they had the Runaways, some version of Runaways.
That's right. And they had
Balls.
Mono Man, the Boston guy.
Yeah.
Liars.
Right.
And all these kind of 60s. I guess you had to have a.
And the Pretty Things.
Pretty Things, Ronnie's favorite band, one of his favorite bands.
Yeah. Right.
But hardly any songs, like two or three songs each, and you're off, and they bring on the next. That was Lil Steven, that's who it was.
Right.
He put it together.
Right. Lil Steven, the actor.
Yeah, rolled up in the limo.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Oh, Stooges got to play a bunch of songs, so for some reason.
I once went to a football game in Randall's Island. And it's stone seats. It's a very uncomfortable place to be.
This one was in a field, but it had rained, so it was soggy ground.
Right.
Yeah, what was it? Was it a dump before or something?
I don't know what it was. I think it was a place where they had classical concerts for...
So it was always...
It was something.
A place, okay.
But the events
I thought
they
it was
had,
like a landfill
they
thing.
They would have like the equivalent of the Boston Pops would play there. You know?
Real straight.
Yeah.
Okay. For some reason, I thought it was like a Staten Island thing where they just landfilled and built stuff
over.
It
might have been how it happened, yeah.
Okay. Have you been back?
I haven't been to... my sister lives in Woodstock.
Upstate.
And if I go there, I fly through Albany. I haven't been to Manhattan in, since 1989.
Okay.
So I haven't seen, you know, like, it hadn't become Disneyland yet. So I don't even know, I have no interest in seeing
it. Yeah. I know I saw you in L.A. with the Smegma. So right. I know you've been down there a couple of times.
Yeah.
Since moving up here.
Right.
How many years? 14 years?
14 years. Yeah. Smegma, like, they kicked me out, like, you know, like, a few months after that show.
Yeah, at the Derby. Right. That was actually the Brown Derby at one
right.
time.
Right. But it was like they kicked me out when I was sick of it. It was down to like they would do maybe four gigs a year.
Yeah.
And but practice every Thursday night. Practice. You know, I was just like, practice what? You know. And they never had songs. It was all just jam.
Right, right.
And then they decided, well, let's have songs. Maybe we could get more gigs. And you know, they wanted me to write songs, which I don't know how to do.
I heard you. Yeah, a rock opera.
Yeah, that was Jackie's idea. She thought, yeah, come on, you know, a rock opera is just what we need.
Oh, you mean writing lyrics, like writing a song?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't sing them. I don't.
No, but you wrote lyrics for Blue Oyster.
Oh, yeah, but I never, I don't know what a melody is.
So you just, like, give them source.
I write a bunch of words on a napkin, and and Albert Bouchard would put together a song.
Music behind it.
Yeah.
Wow. Because they had Albert in Sandy, the manager man.
Right.
He had an idea of a rock opera. I think they
had it was called Imaginos. It was,
They ended up doing it, right?
It was, you know, it was like after they weren't doing any, Columbia didn't want them anymore pretty much, but they still had all the stuff in the can that Perlman wanted to be released as Imaginos. It's his record. And then, let's do it as the Cult.
Oh, okay. And that was an all worked out thing.
He had, like, he'd come to L.A. once in a while, and Robbie Krieger played on that.
Oh, really?
Can you play some slide for us? I don't know if he's on the release of it, but I saw him record with them.
I know Albert was a big part of it.
Oh, yeah.
One time Albert was telling me about it.
He was the one guy from that band who was willing to be. Everybody hated Sandy by then, so.
Okay. Did you go to college with him?
I went to junior high school, and college with him. He was in some ways my best friend, and then he burned me out of like $20,000
on
royalties from Burning for You.
Oh wow, yeah. Which still makes the FM radio.
Right, less.
So Burning for You, that was on a napkin.
Yeah.
That's Buck Garner.
I think I sent
you. That ain't Albert, is it?
Right. I sent it to them. I probably sent it to both Buck and Albert. You know, there was this guy, what the hell was his name? Steve something. Steve Schenck was like Perlman's lieutenant. He was like the guy, the store boss of the band. Sometimes I'd send him the lyrics and he'd kind of just pass them around. But it was always like they used about one-tenth of what I gave them. I think they recorded 13 of my songs with SBOC. And before that, when they were the Stock Forest group, they recorded seven of my songs that they never used again, that I thought were the best things I ever gave.
That Stock Forest thing came out.
Yeah.
Somebody released
limited
it.
Limited edition on Electra.
Maybe Rhino?
Yeah, it was Electra / Rhino.
Yeah.
But that was stuff they did when they were a psychedelic pop band before they
Maybe Grateful Dead influence a little bit.
Absolutely. And like Buck listened to Jerry Garcia.
Yeah.
There's a cut,
you can hear it.
There's a cut called Cream Puff War on the first Dead album, and you can hear those licks.
Wow.
And Buck.
And Albert told me something about the Blues Project, Al Kooper.
Oh, yeah. And Danny Kalb was the.
That was a big influence on them.
Oh, yeah. But Buck says that growing up, his big influences were stuff like Santo and Johnny. You know who they were? He did instrumentals on titles like Sleepwalk.
Well, his pop was a sax player.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. But he was...
Santo and Johnny.
He was kind of, I mean, the thing about, they were all short. And Buck,
And
Buck was short.
Mr. Lanier, maybe.
Right. So in the Stark Forest, they did, somebody did a drawing for the cover. They had, you know, shots of the faces, and the person didn't know how tall everybody was. So they were all tall on the cover of the Stark Forest CD.
Yeah, I didn't. Now, if you look at the pictures, you see how big the guitars are. I didn't. Arena rock. Everybody was little, so I never knew.
Right.
But now, if I look back, you see it too with the, that Rick Derringer album.
Yeah.
He's got gloves on, right?
Right.
And the guitar. Yeah. As a kid, you had no idea.
It was in the McCoys, I think, Rick Derringer.
And then White Trash.
I saw them open for the Rolling Stones at the Academy of Music in the late 65.
That's like one of the first ones, right?
Yeah.
The Academy.
Right. And that was another show you couldn't hear anything.
Couldn't.
Even a closed room, they didn't know how to do sound yet. Right. Yeah. But it was,
the sound was pretty bad when I was going to those 70s gigs too. Oh man! But at least you could hear something. But you couldn't really hear bass.
But Smegma, you saw the Smegma show at the Derby. Then we played. I think the next night we played at some art house in Silver Lake, where they had no sound. And
no.
It was like you didn't bring your own PA.
wow.
You know, it was bad.
You sounded great though, Derby.
I thought so, yeah.
And Steve McKay played with you.
Right.
That's because he was on with the opening band, or did he play with Smegma a lot?
He played with us a little bit, you know, like off and on. And we did a recording with him. I don't know if it ever came out.
Oh yeah, he told me about that.
Yeah.
Maybe something for the Radon Collective.
Right.
I think it is.
Right.
What about writing books? When did you start writing books?
Well,
I
never wanted to be a writer.
Yeah,
I was a philosophy major in college, so I write these papers. But I never took an English class. I never read literature, and all the writing I did was this very kind of scholarly. It was probably a very awkward attempt at scholarship, but I wrote a lot of papers when I was in college. And then when the Crawdaddy came out, I started writing in the same style. I'd review the Between the Buttons album and things like this. And I was very lucky that to get started at a time when you had all these mags. Little by little, there were, you know, between 67 and 70, there were like 30 mags.
Right. A lot of them shills, right?
And they would all, oh yeah. But it was like, they'd pay you like $12.50. And if that's all they're going to pay you, they'd take anything you give them.
But was it quite anymore like people really liked the music?
Oh yeah, they didn't pay anything. But I mean, they'd have magazines with names like Big Fat from somewhere in Michigan. And you just write for them and they'd take anything you gave them because
nobody was doing it.
It wasn't every kid doing it yet. And so that's how I got my chops, doing,
When is the Aesthetics of Rock?
That was mostly an expansion of a paper that I did when I was a junior in college.
Yeah.
And I wrote that in 65, basically. And when nobody was writing about rock and roll, and I just thought, yeah, I got to do this. I got to write about it.
What was the take? Most people, this is little kid music.
Oh,
and nobody's going to write about it.
At the time, it was like even jazz was like, you know, only a very few people wrote about jazz. You know, and how do you write about music anyway?
Yeah, really.
Right? So you're writing mostly about the lyrics. But jazz, it's harder to do because you don't have the lyrics.
No lyrics.
But so I think the easiest hook was you had lyrics to quote. And the problem was when it finally became a book, it took 5 years for the book to come out. Didn't come out until 70 because they had to clear the lyrics with the publishing companies and the artists, and some people wanted to get paid. And this was a little company called the Something Else Press. You know, they put out books by John Cage and things like that. So I remember that Bob Dylan wanted $75 for any little quote, just a fraction of a line. And $1,000 if you quoted a whole song.
Wow.
So I wrote about Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
You know, like 40 years before Grill Marcus did a book about it. I wrote a pretty good stretch of pages about it, and it was entirely dropped from the book because I couldn't afford
money. How did you get it? Did you have an agent then?
No. Nah. How did I get it? I was the book was turned down 7 or 8 times. The first place was Grove Press. It was some sociology teacher named Ned Polsky who knew somebody at Grove Press. Richard Seaver, who was like somebody who just died about 6 months ago, who published after he was with Grove. He had his own company, Seaver Books, and then a company called Arcade. But a lot of Beatnik books, and Samuel Beckett, and you know, lots of stuff. And anyway, he turned it down. and I was just very crestfallen. And then it was turned down by this hipster named Alan Rinsler. He was at, I think, Macmillan Books. And he was this guy who would snap his fingers and say, "Hey, who did the original version of this is dedicated to the one I love?" You know, he had to prove that he was Hef. And he was just a jivous guy. He turned it down.
Yeah.
And then a little later, he was at Rolling Stone, and he became the editor-in-chief at Stray Arrow Books. They had a publishing house for a while. And he put out Gulcher.
Wow.
Because he felt like, "Oh, hey, you're happening now. I got to put you out." Yeah. But anyway, a bunch of places turned down Aesthetics of Rock. And then finally this guy, what the hell was his name? He had this company, Something Else Press.
Yeah.
Well, I can't remember his name. But anyway,
the jerks can't remember.
But anyway, he was Dick something or other. And he...
Thank you, Dick. That was my pop's name.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember called Dick?
I was called Dick E.
Okay, Dickie.
Little Dickie.
My pop was never called Richard.
Yeah.
Except my mother in the anger thing. So right. He's always Dick what? But you know what? It's his middle name. He was never called James.
Right.
What's that about?
Right. Yeah, Dick Higgins was his guy.
Dick Higgins, all right. And thank
so,
you, Dick Higgins.
So they got the Beatles, they got the rights to quote the Beatles stuff. What happened was John Cage was putting out a book called Notations. It was a bunch of oddball musical sheets where guys or composers would write their stuff down. And he wanted to get a handwritten Beatle lyric. And so he called up his friend Yoko Ono in London and said,
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So, and so Yoko is having a show of her stuff. And she invites John Lennon to the show. And that's how they met.
Was because of,
because
wow.
Because Yoko, you know, was asked to get a Beatle manuscript.
You know, she's making an album. She resurrected the Plastic Ono Band. 75 years old.
Right.
A friend of mine did a gig with her in Tokyo. 75 in hot pants came on stage.
Right. But anyway, so she gets this Beatle lyric,
right.
And it goes in a book, and that's so the company had some connection to the Beatles. And then to get the rights to the lyrics, Paul McCartney was just hooking up with Linda, and so he said, "Oh, if you get me an autographed copy of such and such a book in your catalog, autographed to Linda for Valentine's Day, you can have the rights to any Beatles stuff you want." So that's how they got the Beatles rights. And
wow, you know, total coincidence.
Oh yeah,
wow.
But anyway, so that was book number one. And by the time it came out, it was 5 years out of date.
Right.
It was like maybe it was the first rock book written, but it was about the 10th to come out. But I got a lot of instant. Party invites and stuff. The summer of 1970, I just get to get on all the mailing lists, and then when
you have arrived.
Then when Gulcher came out, a couple of years later, I had two books, and then I stopped having books for a few years.
Yeah, right.
And then they started, observing my behavior. I was in uncouth loud at these parties, and so they would throw me off all the mailing lists. And
by this time, you stopped writing reviews and
all that. I couldn't take it anymore.
I remember you telling me you were just looking at album covers.
Oh, yeah, I did a lot of reviews where I didn't listen to the records. Yeah. But in those days, I was nasty. I might put, these days, if I did that, I would give a positive review for things I didn't listen to. But then I would even, mock and put the band down if I didn't even know who they were. And now, that's a little nasty.
Okay.
But anyway, so I was just a bad boy of that scene, and that's half of why. And meanwhile, I was writing for the Village Voice,
yeah.
Where you had these Robert Christgau and Richard.
He didn't like Jim Morrison.
Hated him.
Yeah. So maybe that's where I'm thinking of anti-New York.
Right, but they came to hate me because they thought I was an anti-intellectual. And I should be tarred.
You told me about the party he comes with Dina Rock on his shirt.
Oh, he always, Robert Chris got Dina of American Rock for his picture of Little Richard.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right. But he was, they just kind of really, they thought I was just too, on one hand, too sloppy. I didn't yet think it was important to write. To be articulate, I would just do a scattergun kind of all.
Yeah, yeah. Very vernacular,
And when I did say something right on the dime, they didn't like what I said.
Okay.
I mean.
Oh, what about the Lester and the Cream thing?
Well.
That comes out of Crawdaddy.
Yeah, I mean, Cream was the best of the Rock Max, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And then before Lester was the editor, Dave Marsh was the editor.
Right, right.
And he was a kind of like happy-go-lucky kid. The first time I met him, he had two Budweisers, one in each hand.
Two fists.
You know, and he was 20 years old, and he was a fun guy.
Yeah.
And then he became a real stiff, like, quickly. And as stiff that he is today. And but anyway, Lester was living in San Diego, and then he went to work in...
Dearborn?
Oh, they were in a town called Walled Lake, Michigan.
Walled Lake.
Suburb of Detroit, I guess.
Yeah, Ronnie told me you used to go over to that house.
Right. So Lester was the editor for a while. He was really he was always a great friend, but as an editor, he'd just make these ridiculous demands. He'd call you up 4 o'clock in the morning. I need something on the doors by noon. Can you write it? And it wouldn't run, and it would
just, Chris Cow was in that too, though.
A little bit. Okay, the Consumer Guide, yeah.
Yeah.
That was syndicated, yeah.
That's what it was, syndicated.
But Lester was, then Lester moved to...
I thought he actually took stuff and put his name on it.
Oh, I'm sure I did that. I used to use other people's names all the time. I had a couple of pseudonyms of my own that I liked. One was Borneo Jimmy, and then the Dictators did a song called Borneo Jimmy, and then I had another one, Audie Murphy Jr. But I would use other rock writers' names. Yeah.
Dick's got a bar now.
Right. Did you ever go there?
I went there once. Yeah.
Yeah.
I met somebody.
There's just two guys playing. And it's just very seamless. It's just like, it's almost like it's blues.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it's played for God. Like, what's the audience of this? This guy recorded 4 sides in his life and then just disappeared.
Oh, wow.
And one was this two-sided thing. And it's just like, about the terror of life. My baby left me and I'm going to kill her. And, like,
okay. Yeah. What do you think of that stuff, like the Fat Possum? People trying to get back to that field.
Some of it's good. You ever see T Model Ford?
Yeah.
It was like he learned guitar when he was 70.
Right, right.
He plays a ride, he sits there with a little bottle of whiskey while he's playing, and he can play all this.
Arl Burnside. And
sure. I saw Daniel Johnston open for Arl Burnside.
How about some?
And the audience was always there for Burnside, not for him. And he says, where's the groupies tonight? I thought there'd be a groupies for me.
I met him when he was a teenager. He's quite a piece.
He was managed by his father.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Keeps him on a tight leash.
Had to. He almost tried to kill him.
Right.
Right? Grab the wheel of the airplane.
Right.
He came to a couple of my gigs all week. Steve Shelley took him under his wing, the Sonic Youth drummer, for a while.
Yeah.
And it was just, very difficult. Small sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
Okay. And then this one, which one?
The number, I think, let me see the number on this. Number 11 on this one. Rube Lacey, Ham Hound Crave.
Ham Hound.
I think it's from 1928, and it's like everything that rock and roll would ever be. It's like it's about pussy.
Yeah.
And so it says, I don't need no kissing, don't need no hugging. Mama got a ham bone. I wonder, can I get it boiled? And he ended up being a man of the Lord, a minister who moved to L.A., yeah, in Mississippi.
Wow.
And maybe Dave Allen said he ran into him.
Oh, so he's...
He was still alive in the 60s.
Older man, but...
Yeah.
Ham Hound Crave. Who went religious? Ham Hound Cake. That's a different one.
Ham Hound Crave.
But there's Ham Hound Cake.
Yeah.
Or maybe they fucked up.
Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah, number 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a company called Grace Harmony, and they're supposedly the database that these things go after.
Yeah.
But this is the way the internet is. You only have to have one place for the changes. And
yeah,
there's no pieces of paper. There's no...
Right.
My house has a copy, your house. No, one right thing. So very fragile.
It's not, you know, the document, the archive is suspect.
Yeah, very central. You know, the one... What the guy, Winston Smith's job, right? Who won the chess game.
Right. Well, it's also like the... book publishers don't, and LA Times, whatever. Nobody does fact checking anymore.
Because
you go online and the facts aren't checked there.
No.
So.
Okay, let's play this.
It's warm in here.
So.
I got the heater going.
So play these three things and then talk. Come
yeah
back on.
Yeah.
Lord, it walked a dead road. in trouble everywhere you go. I said trouble, yeah, mama, you're trouble everywhere you go. And I said trouble, yeah, mama, baby, good girl, I don't know.
Pedro Show, that was some songs Richard picked there. That was Rube Lacey with Ham Hound Crave.
Yeah, which was like recorded in 1928, and it's like everything in rock and roll years later would be. In a nutshell, it was like, I think he recorded maybe four sides total, Rube Lacey, and this one is like, I don't need no hugging, I don't need no kissing, Mama got a ham bone. I wonder, can I get it boiled? You know, that says everything rock and roll would later try to say.
What was Tutti Frutti about?
Wop, bop, bop. She rocked me to the east. She rocked me to the west. But anyway, Rube Lacey used to be, if you played these like juke joints and fish fries, it would just be everybody's drinking like corn liquor, and somebody would get stabbed every time he played. You know, we just, and so some of these people decided I gotta give up this life or I'm gonna go to hell.
Right.
You know, maybe I'll get stabbed the next time I play. So he was one of those guys who just thought this is too dangerous.
I'm getting out.
Changing my destiny. So he became the preacher. And
the guy I was trying to remember is Mark Farner.
He became. Oh, well, he's a preacher?
No. Well, he does the thing at the end of the gig where you get to testify or something backstage.
Okay.
So I've heard from people playing the gigs, man, it runs late.
Yeah.
One at a time.
Right. But anyway, that song, you know, that was, I think they got the title on the record is Ham, Hound, Crave. And I think they asked him, what's the title of that one? And I think he said, Ham, Hound, Gravy. And they got it wrong. It's Ham, Hound.
And the Greystone people called it Ham, Hound, Cake.
Cake. Close.
It's going to be forever fucked up.
Right. But before that, it was part one and two of Garfield Akers' Cotton Blues, which sounds to me like, you know, he's... You know, you play, maybe these records would sell 800 copies or something like that. And in the 40s, these white collectors would find old scratchy 78s. Let's see what we got here.
Yeah, right.
So once in a while, they were able to reconstruct who was this person anyway.
Right.
And I think that Garfield Akers also did a total of four sides and then disappeared from the face of the earth.
Yeah, not a preacher.
But the guy that he's playing with on there... what the hell is his name? He ended up being rediscovered, as they say, during the Newport Folk Festival, the early 60s. They'd send these expeditions down south and say, hey, can we, you know, is Skip James still alive? You know, like Bob Height from Ken Heat and John Fahey. Al Wilson from Ken Heat. They'd all go down and who can we find? And somehow Joe Callicott was his name.
Billy Gibbons did that with Lightnin' Hopkins.
Lightnin' Hopkins always had a little bit of visibility, but some of these people just, they went back to being sharecroppers.
Oh, yeah, right, quit.
You know?
Yeah.
So Joe Callicott was found, I think R. Hooley recorded some sides by him in the 60s. And even after being rediscovered, he disappeared again, and they're not even sure when he died. They think he died about 72, but they're not sure.
We skipped over that period in the 60s, folk. Because I was just thinking of Ronnie. Ronnie told me there was a period where he wore a corduroy coat and smoked a pipe.
Right.
To see Ron
Ashton. Right. A lot of that was like, you know, you read Playboy magazine and every other ad was for pipe. A smoking jacket and a pipe.
And he said he went to folk gigs. It wasn't really until the Beatles really brought on this electric music to bands. Yeah.
And like Dylan was the guy, his first meet the music he grew up with was rock and roll in Minnesota. And when he went to folk, because rock was sort of not happening for a while, and he just threw some intensity in folk there.
Right.
He wanted to, tune in on. And then,
did you go to some of those pads in New York City, folk pads?
I went to Gertie's Folk City. We're doing
his first gig.
I didn't see him. I saw Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, and everybody was wearing a loose fitting sweater. All the guys wore loose fitting sweaters. Some with a tie under the sweater.
And the elbow patch.
Right. Well, it's kind of a dreary place, you know.
Because there was another one, Folk City West.
Right.
Later on.
Yeah.
That's the first Minuteman. New York City gig. He played with a band called President of the United States.
Right.
Not this other one from Seattle, but this is years before. They were Fusion.
Right. But I want to play, we could do this next one, Eric. It's like Dylan, I got like Dylan on one of these records. He did Time Out of Mind, which is an album.
Is that newer?
Well, no, this is from maybe the 80s.
That's what I mean by newer.
Yeah, this has been 92. But whatever that was.
Have you heard his radio show?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It seems scripted.
I never heard it.
It doesn't sound like he's saying anything that he came up with himself.
Okay.
Wow. You know, like I say, he put on Charles Aznavour's. He's written over 1,000 songs. I'm familiar with 500 of them, I'm sure.
I saw him for the first time in my life. Stu just played this Plimco racetrack in Maryland.
Pimlico. Yeah, that's where they have the Preakness.
Where a woman just won.
Right.
Philly. Pettibone Big Pony Man. I'm learning from him. But anyway, I see Bobby Dylan for the first time. He's dressed mariachi. He only will play keyboard and some harmonica, no guitar.
I saw him play with Time Out of Mind, which was the first album of his. That was about 97. I thought it was a concept album where every song was about death and dying, growing old. They're very, I thought it was the best album he ever did.
Better than that 60s.
Better than Blonde and Blonde, yeah. And
bringing it all back
very,
home.
Yeah, but very grim, but just perfectly, conceived. And then so I started listening. I got the ones he did before that. He did these two folk albums where it was just him with acoustic guitar. One is called Good As I've Been to You, and the other is World Gone Wrong, where he just does, and he has like songs that Jerry Garcia played for him once, and about the Civil War. And so there's this one here, Jim Jones. It's just this terrific song, sung with an Australian accent. About a guy, a British
Bobby,
a British criminal being sent to Botany Bay in 1770 or whatever, and they'll yet regret they sent Jim Jones in chains to Botany Bay. It's something about revenge.
Yeah, right.
And it's like so that's on here, and then there's this other one where he does Step It Up and Go, which was originally done by Blind Boy Fuller, who was not just blind but mean. He once tried to shoot his wife. He took shots at her. He was blind.
Wow,
he
didn't
hit her. But when 1937 or 39, whenever they had this thing called Spirituals to Swing, John Hammond put on, John Hammond Sr., who was by then, I think, Benny Goodman's brother-in-law. And so he puts on this event where starts with like spirituals and works its way up to where the high point of American music is Benny. It all leads to Benny. But they wanted to get Robert Johnson to play, they had heard Robert Johnson's records, let's get him. They didn't realize he was already dead a few months.
Many years.
So who we get? So then, how about Blind Boy Fuller? And he's in jail for trying to shoot his wife. So Mississippi, Arkansas guy who moved to Big Bill Brunzy. They got him instead.
Big Bill Brunzy.
So I got the Blind Boy Fuller version of Step It Up and Go is not one-tenth as hot as Bob Dylan's version.
Wow.
So we could play the...
Yeah, but next hour, because the second hour of Watt from Pedro show, May 22, 2009 is over. Hang tight for hour three. May 22, 2009, it's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
Come and listen for a moment, lads, and hear me tell my tale. How across the sea from England I was condemned to sail. By the jury found me guilty, then says the judge, says he, for life in Jordan, sending you across the stormy sea. But take a trip before you ship to join the Iron Gang. Come get to gay in Botany Bay, or else you'll surely hang. Or else you'll surely hang, says he. And after that, Jim Jones is high up upon the gallows tree. The crows will pick your bones. It was high on the sea when pirates came along, but the soldiers on a convict ship were full 500 strong. Oh, they opened fire and somehow drew that pirate ship away, but I'd rather have joined that pirate ship and gone to Botany Bay. storms raging round us and the winds are blowing gales. I'd rather have drowned in misery than gone to New South Wales. There's no time for mischief, as they say. Remember that the day, oh, they're flogged the button out of you down there in Botany Bay. The irons clanging like poor galley slaves. We toil and toil, and when we die, must build this honored grave. That is by and by, all slipknot chains into the bush I'll go, and I'll join the brave bush rangers there, Jack Donner, Hugh and Poe. And some dark night when everything is silent in the town, I'll see the sirens, one and all, I'll gun the bloggers down. Oh, I'll give the lot a little shock to remember what I say, and they'll yet regret they've sent Jim Jones in chains to buy me back.
16 padlocks, but you got to step it up and go. Got a little girl, she stays upstairs, try to make a living by putting on airs. You got to step it up and go. Yeah, yeah. Well, you can't stand padlocks, I swear you got to step it up and go. Pray for me now. Yes, yes, yes. Step it up and go, and go. Well, you can't stand paradise, but you got to step it up and go. Yeah. Now, I got a little gal named with Ball. Give a little bit and she took it all. You got to step it up and go.
Sorry about that. Would anybody want their hearts to go so fast?
When you're young, you're into that.
Right.
No.
But it's also the idea, hey, well, I'm going to stay awake for 3 days.
Get a lot of work? Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess. That's the real danger, though, even more than the chemicals, not caulking and then the hallucination.
Right.
A lot of working people in my town. Speedro.
Are we on the air now?
Yeah.
Because I was, when one of the things Lester Bangs taught me was like a lot of these beats would, when you could get these Benzedrine inhalers. And so, you know, you just like Kerouac, you know, would write for 6 days straight on this stuff. And so.
What did Capote call it? Typing.
Yeah, it's writing. Not writing, it's typing. Yeah, right. Try it sometime. But anyway, Lester said he looked up in a, because the rumor was there is no Benzedrine in these inhalers anymore. And Lester says it's not true. He looked up at some pharmacopoeia where it says whatever they're calling this drug now is equivalent to Benzedrine.
To keep choice.
So I saw him once, one of the last times I saw him. We went to this Mexican restaurant in Venice, La Cabana, and I says, I don't really want to eat. Can we stop at a drugstore first? I got to get some inhalers. And so he got six inhalers. He broke them. He was sitting on the curb and broke them open with a shoe. And he swallowed six cottons. And we went inside. He had a he was still he's like burping and everything. He had to wash it down. He said, I don't really drink anymore, but I need a beer to wash this down. And he was just like a mess. And so I thought I'd better try this. And so a few weeks later, I had a deadline. I had to write something really quick. So I did an inhaler, and I was like breathing menthol for 3 days. It worked pretty good, actually.
You know Charlie Blumel?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a good cat. I got to meet him.
Huh.
And Zap Comics and
right.
Living with Ginsberg and Kesey and. Actually,
you mean
Wichita.
Thurston or Byron, those people?
Yeah. They had me come read poems in Western Massachusetts. And I meet this guy. He's living in Cherry Valley.
Right. Yeah. Well, he has that book, Cherry Valley Editions, the company.
It's kind of upstate New York.
Right.
Amazing man. I got to live some life.
Yeah.
It's still living life.
Right.
And, you're sort of like the Stooges thing with this primary source. Yeah. You know, there's things that aren't second, third, fourth, fifth air.
Clyde Mell wrote a great, nasty, angry poem directed to Allen Ginsberg, like at a certain point in the 80s where Allen had just, gone commercial.
Weirded out, yeah.
And he just screamed at him in his poem.
Wow.
And,
but The Last of Moxins, beautiful book. Just to let me borrow it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
And Neil Cassidy was living with him when Kennedy got shot.
Yeah.
The night they both heard that Kennedy got shot.
Yeah, he said he was a piece of work. Denver.
Right.
And I met Barbara Tall Bob. He's another Kansas cat.
Yeah.
This guy, he's in his 70s. He came to one of my gigs. I didn't really know the beat thing. I'm learning a lot about it now. Not a lot of cats. It's kind of a small scene.
Well, sometimes I sit down and I'll try to make a list. Short list is small, but there's maximum about 35 people.
Yeah.
and three of them come were in Portland. You know, it's like in 1956, Allen Ginsberg read the poem Howl live for the first time in San Francisco. Five poets read at this thing, and one of them, Allen Ginsberg, is from New York. Michael McClure is from Kansas. Philip LaMantia was from San Francisco, and two poets, Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen, were from Portland. So the most overrepresented town was Portland.
Wow.
And so the whole myth that, New York meets San Francisco, and that's when it happens. No, it was New York meets Portland in San Francisco. I mean, and these guys got Kerouac interested in becoming a lookout, a fire lookout. In the
Right.
And, they got this whole Northwestern sensibility from three guys, Philip Whalen, Gary Snyder, and Lew Welch. And Lew Welch is, like, to me, the most romantic figure of the whole lot. They all went to Reed College together.
Yeah.
And Lew was a guy who, it hasn't been verified, but it is claimed, he worked for an ad agency, and it is claimed, after he went to school, his mother said, get a job.
Yeah.
So he couldn't go directly to San Francisco to be a poet.
Yeah, right.
So he worked for an ad agency, and it is claimed that he coined the phrase, raid kills bugs dead, and that he hated himself for this.
Yeah.
And Allen Ginsberg said, no, it's great, it's all consonants, raid kills bugs dead. But he felt this grief that, what you got to do in America to survive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he just became a terrible, terrible drunk living in San Francisco. And after Neil Cassidy was no longer Kerouac's drive ride, Lew Welch became Jack's Wheels. Yeah. And after a while, Jack dies. He's just a drunk every day for 7 years.
Right.
And
like Lou, a quarter day.
And Lou is like that. And Lou, his last woman, her name was Magda Craig, and her son's name was Huey Craig, who went on to become Huey Lewis. He took the Lewis in honor of Lewis Welch.
Wow.
But anyway, Lou, after he's just so, after a while, inconsolably miserable, and he's just, I can't live anymore. So he writes his greatest poem, Song of the Turkey Buzzard, in honor of, Vulture. And he says,
please. I see a lot of them torn, believe me.
Yeah. And he says, please, don't grieve for me. Leave my body on a rock. I want to enter the food tube of nature. Turkey Buzzard, descend.
Wow.
And so he ran in the woods with his gun in 1972. It was never found. It is assumed he knew to get deep enough in the woods that they'd never find him. And
maybe the turkey buzzard got him.
And the turkey buzzard's found him.
Wow.
But anyway, he spent time in Portland.
And Charlie ends up working on the docks in San Francisco. He said his best job he had.
Well, he probably knew Lou worked on the docks too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, the beach, this is what I spend my time doing. I read old beatnik books.
Yeah. Interesting stuff.
And there's no such thing as beatnik style, because they, you know, if there are 35 of them, they write at least 27 different ways. You know.
With Bukowski, he was a younger guy on the scene and an outsider.
He was too much of a loner. He hated, you know, associating.
You know, he's buried in my town. Yeah. His last 14 years there.
He loathed all those people and wouldn't read with them.
Just, he's staying at the same hotel as Burroughs and he won't meet him.
Right. The only one that he had any real contact with was a guy named Jack Micheline, who was sort of a street poet, a guy who lived in San Francisco and kept getting thrown out of hotels. He had like 40 suitcases containing all his writings.
Charlie said he liked Bukowski. And I met him a few times in town. Yeah. He was always very nice to me. You would, from the writing, think this guy was the meanest fucker.
He was all over the place.
Yeah, he was.
But there's this woman named Liza Williams who, she's in one of those Bukowski documentaries, and she was the head of publicity at Island Records, and she hooked up with Bukowski, and I got to go to dinner with them in 72 or something. And he was really nasty to her, and after a dumped her, she said, "I wouldn't give him the ice in winter." And she just, I used to be in touch with her, and she was like a bipolar, and little by little, she couldn't take the lithium anymore. It was destroying her cerebellum, they told her. So she had,
very strong.
She went off meds and just became a lunatic. And she disappeared from the face of the earth. She was late 70s, and she used to call me crazy. Whenever she called me, she was just out of her mind. And then she disappeared 2 years ago, and nobody knows what happened to her.
Well, Linda Bukowski still lives in Cuba.
She was like so hell and gone that Linda Bukowski sent Liza a check for $1,000. I think you could use this. Liza ripped it up. The nerve of that woman! You know, what's she trying to do? Okay?
Linda came to some Minuteman gig.
I wanted the next thing we play, which we still have to queue up.
Charles
Mingus, Hit the Canthropus Erectus.
I'm
sort of a newly.
What about the Beneath the Underdog? You like that?
Oh yeah.
Is that
true? Hey, it's pretty good. There's people who say he actually had 1,000-page manuscripts. So what happened to the rest of it? You know.
I don't care if some of it's made up. Maybe. Right. I think it gives you a sense of music.
Right.
Feel music.
Oh yeah, I met him in New York because he was married to this Susan Graham, who had a magazine called Changes, and he did a song, Sue's Changes.
Right.
But he used to play Christmas time, she had a Christmas party every year, and Mingus 1 year made the eggnog, and the next year he made mulled wine. He says, "Eggs ain't good for you, so I'm not making my eggnog again."
Did you get to rap with him?
It was very hard to talk to him. He was surly Bukowski kind of way. But anyway, the first time I'm newlywed. I've been married 11 months.
Right.
This wonderful woman who saved my life, darling Jessica, who will hear this out. This is the first time I went to her house. The first thing she was playing, I mean, she's was Spit the Canvas Records.
We were talking about this yesterday with Jackie McLean. Yeah. You know, I start writing punches of him.
Yeah.
It wrecks his ambition, you know, he takes a nut and ripped his shirt.
Yeah.
Only put a scratch on Mingus. But of course, a month later, he's playing back with him, and Mingus would open up his shirt. Hey, Jackie.
Yeah.
Just go to him.
Also, there was a guy named, what the hell was his name? Trombonist Jimmy Neffer, who's not on this record, but he's a terrific white trombonist. That he got in, permanent falling out with Mingus at some point, and to the point where when they did
Danny Richmond, was his usual drummer. Played through a lot of these.
He was his best drummer, right.
Oh, well, there's that one that he puts out on Charles Mingus Records. It was supposed to be the UCLA gig or something.
Oh, yeah, that's
kicks
true.
The whole band off.
Right. It's got some title like Music Written for Performance at Monterey Pop Festival, not played. Yeah.
And he boots the band off, right? They're sinking it up against it. Slowly brings them back up. Right. Lets them down to think.
It was that, so they did this thing called Epitaph a few years ago.
Yeah, right.
Which is so, you know, like, is nothing ferocious about it. It's not the way it's like, it's a long piece of composed music that he wrote, but it's not performed. They get Wynton Marsalis and people.
Oh, I know.
And it's just very tame, and it doesn't have any of the feel that Mingus would have wrote.
Hey, thing about Wynton, there's a Bernstein that Nels told me about. The guy who does Baseball, Civil War, All Out of Order and shit. He said there's no Mingus in the jazz one.
Is that right? Because I think it may be the last day of the last 10 minutes of it, they show you, and then after Louis Armstrong. And
I think
they have one brief cameo by Mingus. And that's
And Nels was telling me, no Mingus.
Right. The whole thing is like Gary Giddens, who was like this... another guy at the Village Voice who hated me because I said that Eric Dolphy played punk rock, and he wrote this nasty letter. How dare you,
Dolphy was great.
Yeah, and so was punk rock. So,
yeah. Yeah, he was wild.
But anyway, he's in that...
he was straight, huh? He was diabetes or something.
Right, he was very straight. He was from L.A.
The L.A. cat.
Right.
The bump.
I went to visit his, at some point, I knew his address, and I went down and took a picture of his house. Very, he's been dead 10, 12, 15 years, and very perfectly kept home, nice porch, everything.
His stuff is, I heard about him and Train doing these big pracs together, and with a jar of honey, and he didn't, slowly.
He also listened to birds to get the birds from. And,
he was... You could tell discipline on his thing, man. He wanted to get a sound.
Right.
He has great tone. Where I love Train's tone too, but a little more wild. The Dolphy's wild playing, but his execution is like, man.
Right. I remember I went to, there was a Dolphy memorial thing that happened when I was still in L.A. somewhere early 90s. And I read some poem that I wrote about Dolphy, and Vinnie Golia played. And there was this kid there who was, maybe 20 years old, who somehow knew Dolphy's family. And they gave him a package of clarinet reeds, Dolphy's reeds.
Wow.
And he gave one to Vinnie, and he says, wow, man. And the last time I saw Vinnie, I said, whatever happened to the Dolphy reed? He says, I lost it.
Oh, man. Well, they say about Train's reeds were really thick.
Right.
He cut them himself. And like most guys couldn't even get a note out of
them. Sort of Charlie Parker. Like, you'd have whatever the toughest to play reed was, he'd cut it down and make it even tougher. But anyway, when my wife-to-be, Jessica, played this for me at her home, I realized we were very connected very quickly. And one of the first things she talked about was the original version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Sam Peckinpah makes a cameo appearance and plays a meter reader. And it was like we were very sympathetic.
Oh yeah,
sense of
that's
culture.
Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah. Right.
I was a meter reader.
Anyway, so I fell for this woman after.
Right, right. But she had such knowledge.
3 years, and I didn't want to destroy things by flirting too heavily. It took me 3 years to.
3 years.
To get to.
So slow grow.
And then, we it seemed like to realize that we were culturally.
Simpatico.
And then I realized we were very, perfectly matched iconoclasts. Yeah, that we both had a kind of.
Well, this means the meanest guy is. Let's fight.
Yeah.
So let's hear.
Thank you.
Okay. That's Pithecanthropus erectus. Charles, I mean, is this supposed to be some missing link?
It's supposed to be one of those, like, fossil remains of something like a human that's stood erect.
Right, okay. You know? But more important, it's what played for you.
Right, my wife, Jessica.
And see how humans interact through the arts and the fabric.
But that's a song that... you know, my friend Greg Burke and I, we had an argument that somebody in writing claimed that it was
about... What was his band? Dred Scott?
Yeah. Right. And he's a guy who he was treated badly by the LA Weekly.
It's a writer for
him. And after that, treated badly by the LA Times. Now he's got a website, metaljazz.com, where all he writes about is metal. And yes.
Yeah. Well, you guys got an argument over this too.
Claiming somebody wrote about how that the song must be about murder, like prehistoric man that is most violent.
Right.
And Greg says, no, I think it's about killing a mastodon. It's about a hunt.
Fables by Fathers. I think his titles were important to me.
Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah, Mama don't like no shortening bread.
I was just reading about Orville Faubus and how.
What a piece of work!
And originally, that he was willing to integrate Little Rock, and then Eisenhower, somebody, you know, leaned on him to make sure that he was going to do it. And it's, no, yeah. And he was like a liberal Democrat, but don't lean on me.
Right.
You know.
My pop's grandpa was from Earl, Arkansas, and I finally got the nerve to go there.
Yeah, how is it?
Pass it on. It's beat down.
Yeah.
You could tell there was money there. It's like West Memphis. It was cotton. Like Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
But this guy was not picking. He was a lawyer man and a Klan guy. Huh. Isn't that great? Sometimes roots.
Yeah.
Great thing to learn about.
Yeah.
But I went to the town finally. I mean, they told me this a long time ago, so I would always avoid on tour. It's right off I-40, and but this time, last year, I stopped and I looked at the town.
Yeah.
It was a trip.
I never been.
It's dry. Dry county.
Wow.
Could stop there. Been driving all day and go to the general store. Ethnic China, but it's all obvious, you know, and... we'll have to go down a road because it's dry.
Because my friend Nick Tosh once did a piece. He wanted to write about the Jack Daniel's distillery for some.
More counties,
some
dry.
Mag. He goes down there, it's dry. You know.
It's embodied out. Yeah. Oh, they show you this giant safe. Man, this safe killed Mr. Jack Daniel's. You think about this thing? Well, he got a statue from Italy, but he had to put giant feet on it because the thing wouldn't stand up for marbles.
Yeah.
Little guy. Well, he booted the safe. And broke the toe. First they cut off the toe, then the foot, and it ends up killing them. Just forgetting the toe.
But see, the foot, you know, the whole proverbial falling safe, you know. Don't get hit by a falling safe. After I had this heart condition a few years ago, I thought, well, you know, I really better look out for falling safe. I got this heart condition from going to the dentist that I got... you know, some microbes.
Right.
When they're cleaning my teeth, poking around, microbes got in my bloodstream and they got to my brain. My brain. My heart.
Endocarditis.
My heart. Yeah, endocarditis. And so I thought, if I can get that, if I get a heart condition at the dentist, I have to watch for fall asleep.
Okay, you know, we were talking about you writing the books. Now, you wrote some, like one of your record things, a horror like Just Raz.
Yeah.
Some books of poetry.
Yeah, right. I have this book called 17 Insects Can Die in Your Heart. That's my poetry.
Right. What about Walking with the Cane? Walking with the... It's a collection, maybe that's one of the poems in it? Is it in 17 Insects? Walking with the Cane. Something with the cane.
Oh, caned out.
Caned out.
Caned out. Okay. That was my autobiography. Okay. I had a dream. Okay. I had a dream Procol Harum, you know, the band Procol Harum, British Invasion. I had a dream that Procol Harum went to like a
lighter painters.
Maybe it was a restaurant opening or a debut of some movie in London, that they all went there with canes and they beat everybody up with canes.
Robin Trower, that's it.
Right. So I wrote it when I got up in the morning, wrote this down, Cane Down.
Cane Down.
And I thought I'll use this for a book title sometime. And it just happened I was doing an autobiography somebody wanted me to do. And oh, let's call that Cane Down.
That's what it was.
Right.
My memory terrible.
Oh, good enough.
Autumn Leaves was the last one.
Autumn Rhythm. Which
Leaves.
Is named for a
track. Autumn Leaves is that song.
Yeah.
Do you know about the tripod? Do you know about Tom Herman?
Who's that?
He played guitar for Pere Ubu, and he made a band called Tripod Jimmy.
Yeah.
And he did a song called Autumn Leaves.
Right.
And the only time he refers to Autumn Leaves is, this is not Autumn Leaves.
Right.
But he calls the song that.
Right. Miles Davis did a version of Autumn Leaves.
Well, like you said, many, many people have done Autumn Leaves. It's a jerker.
Right, but Autumn Rhythm, which I stole the title from a Jackson Pollock painting. It's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Yeah.
And it's big, it's like a whole wall of... it was a painting that the museum paid him $40,000 for this, which... in the early 50s, mid-50s, and it was, at the time, the biggest sale monetarily for any living painter.
Wow.
And he was already pretty far gone. He was just so miserable and... And so even the $40,000, it just enabled him to drink more.
Wow. Something yesterday I want to say to you, too. We were talking Whitman.
Yeah.
And there's a letter from Vincent van Gogh to his brother.
About
Starry Night.
Right.
Song of myself.
What was this? You know,
it's the only time I was inspired by a poem.
Yeah, but what was the guy who did that song,
Rodney
American
Killian
Pie, you know, the guy, what was that guy's
name? Don McLean.
Yeah. Starry Night. Yeah.
Right, and this ridiculous song. And
right.
Yeah, American Pie was the other one.
Right.
PBS.
I heard that what he used to do, like he was making a lot of money from those two songs, but he didn't write enough songs to have an album. You know, he had to have albums. He thought you must. So he would actually hire people to write him the filler for the rest of the albums, the songs that people weren't going to listen to anyway. And in his name, you know. So he just gave him a flat.
But you've been writing. You've been working on writing 6 years now. This book.
I just finished. This was like the thing I was saying before. Is I was very, in a way, very, very lucky to get my chops writing.
Oh, you wrote a book on architecture in L.A.
Yeah, Richard Meltzer's Guide to the Ugliest Buildings in Los Angeles.
And the capital of Kansas.
L.A. is the capital of Kansas. That's my great anti-L.A.
Cultural critique.
But basically, I got these, you know, I had between 1972 when Gulcher came out, and then the poetry book was 83. I went 11 years without a book out. I wrote about 6 books at the time, but nobody wanted them. And so finally I got on a streak again, and the L.A. book came out. And then I had this novel. My first novel was called The Night Alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this one I'm doing now, I did for about 6 years, is called...
The Night Alone, actually, I'm on my practice pad in a little glass wooden frame thing I made.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you. And so this new one is called A World That Don't Exist. And it's the first book that I've ever done where I've gone this long without any publisher in mind, you know.
Right.
I just figured I was old enough. I better do one of these completely to my own specification.
But you like it.
It's great, but it's not going to be easy to sell it. So. But, you know, that's life.
Yeah, that's life. 6-7 years.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of drafts?
Well, the way I did it, it was like, it's sort of like in two parts, but back and forth. One part is sort of like these really low humor, the kind of you can't even laugh at because it's so low. cultural fictions.
Okay.
You know, making up like cigarette fan clubs. You know, hey, kids, you can join. And then, you know, they'd have like a family video parade, you know, some fine films for you to watch with the kids. Movies that contain no fornication, you know. And stuff like that. And it's just stupid.
And then the other world.
And then the other world is like, you know, boy-girl romance at its most, just total folly. Love equals folly. So I go back and forth from the folly of love, which, you know, a fiction that doesn't exist either, to these, you know, a lot of it is recycled. When I was, the last actual gig I had was at the San Diego Reader. I used to do these reviews. I did one on you. Blurbs for upcoming events.
Let's come into town.
So if I knew these people, I could write about them. But most of them were bands I never heard of. So I said, is it okay if I just make it up? I said, sure, just be entertaining. And I did that for about 5 years before they had enough of it and dumped me. But when I did that, I would never make fun of these bands at that stage of my life. I didn't make fun of bands that I had never heard of. I would write raves about them.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there was a band called High School Slit. They'd give me a list of bands coming to town, and I'd pick, every week I'd pick one. And once it was a band called High School Slit, and I never saw any mention of anywhere else. You know, it's the greatest band in the land, High School Slit. And so I have a bunch of those, and it just goes back and forth, and it's kind of like you get these Japanese movies where no matter what happens in terms of the action, the director always goes back to nature. 15 minutes. So I always get back to these dumb, you know, bad jokes. And so I got this, you know, I used to have, maybe I still have, an agent who, he was the guy who was the agent for my last two books, Gorgeous Like the Rest and Autumn Rhythm.
Yeah.
And he can't make head or tail of this one. So it's kind of, you know, it's going to be like pulling teeth.
Is Portland in it?
Yeah. I have, well, the Danny Warhols, who I never...
This band.
Yeah, I never cared about them, really. So I have a blurb for the Danny Warhols where I have a fake address for them. Care of Marco's Pizza. That's across the street from Rocco's Pizza. It's across from, it's near the Crystal Ballroom. Did you ever play there?
Yeah, a couple times.
Right.
I heard Jimmy played there.
Yeah,
that's the rumor. That Jimmy once played there.
Well, I think Grateful Dead played there. There was an acid test with Kesey and the Dead.
Wow,
there.
The bus came.
Yeah, and it was supposedly.
Did you ever see the bus?
No.
Okay.
But the Dead apparently they claimed that was the worst show they ever did with Kesey, because he couldn't get him a place to stay, so they had to drive back to San Francisco from Portland after the show.
That's a hell ride.
Yeah.
And that bus.
Right.
Slow go.
Right. Yeah, with Bill Cassidy. Yeah.
But, well, he probably didn't stop.
Right.
But, have you ever heard his spoken things?
Oh, some of that seems like that Kesey forced him to do it. It feels pressured, you know.
There's a little bit of stress.
But there's some stuff that supposedly there are recordings of that I've seen a transcript of that he and his girlfriend, whatever her name was at the time, I can't remember where my memory's going, but he and his girlfriend weren't getting along, and so they had opening for the Dead two or three early shows when they did clubs. They'd have Cassie and his girlfriend like arguing with each other on stage for 45 minutes.
And there's recordings of that.
And I supposedly
heard. Wow.
Yeah.
That would probably be good.
Right. Right.
Not so scripted.
Right. But he's a guy like, Neil was a guy who, he just, you know, he never ran out of steam until finally he did. He was dead.
Yeah, he ran out of steam. Nailed.
Yeah.
So you think if you weren't in Portland, this book would be different? You like this town?
Well, Portland is a town like it. You know, this town, I was telling you when I lived in New York, they thought I was an anti-intellectual. I moved to L.A. where I was branded as an intellectual, which was even worse. I'm like, oh, you read books? Oh, please. And so I moved to Portland, and here I feel like a citizen.
Yeah,
and that's nice, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's just like a...
So you think it grounds the book?
Well, it grounds
your life.
It gave me a little bit the oxygen in my head. You know, felt like, I mean, I feel like the life that is lived here, it's not quite as quirky and kooky as it was when I moved here 14 years ago, but
yeah.
It's still a place that, part of the appeal is that it's off the mainstream of, you know, the main currents of American life. It's
I hear a lot of young people are coming here, though.
Yeah. There's a funny kind of look here, you know, it's like, I don't know what the terminology is after yuppie, but whatever the next stage of that, there's a lot of that here.
You know, I know, I was told a little weird history about Portland, and it used to be the Shanghai capital.
Oh, yes.
They'd get people buzzed at the bar, and you'd wake up on a boat.
Right. And I think they found, I think recently, a few years ago, they found, some skeletons in the basement underneath. They were doing some construction. And apparently, like 10 or 12 people were in one of these tunnels, and they found a vat of formaldehyde. They thought it was alcohol, and they drank it and died. And their bodies were found 100 years later.
But that was the thing. I'd bring them through these tunnels, get them on boats from the bars, and you'd wake up.
San Diego was like that, too.
San Diego was like that, too, huh?
Yeah.
Somebody told me Portland was the king daddy, and on a boat. I didn't end there, man, because you were lower than low as a Shanghai guy on the boat. And
right. It's also a place like, I looked up once, all the mayors. Portland's had, like, very few two-term mayors. They just had one and another and another and another. They had
no dynasty.
They had a few women, and before other places did. And
I think it was hit hard with that flu after the first war.
Right.
Because the sailors brought it in.
Right.
One time, I was playing. I don't know. What is there a dynamic between here and Eugene?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're close.
But
it's more like the Grateful Dead almost never, after a while, they always played Eugene, they didn't play Portland. And it's an anarchist town, Eugene.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's also, it's college town.
So. Yeah, college town. One time I was in spring, it's like at two towns.
Yeah.
I went into the graveyard and like this wood man of the world.
Yeah, you got some of that in L.A. too.
There's some of that there too?
There's one in Santa Monica, cemetery in Santa Monica, and there's wood man.
Right. And there's a lot of 1919,
1918. Right, that's
true. A flu came and looked up.
But the thing about there's a terrific cemetery about a block from my wife's place where there's, I think, three or four cemeteries that are called Pioneer Cemeteries. This is the Lone Fir Pioneer Cemetery. It has stuff back to the 1850s. And there's a whole section for the Chinamen, you know, who weren't to be buried in the rest. But it has, there's so much rain and whatever the stone they use, a lot of these, the names are washed out. And there's even one where a tree, you can see the stone inside the tree. The tree grew around the stone. So if the family's gone, there's nobody gives a damn about preserving the stuff. And
what do you think about getting buried at sea like ashes? I think that's what I want to do.
Yeah,
off Pedro, if people would want to say bye to me, give them a boat ride.
Right. As opposed to just storing it up in the
And then, maybe I'll wash up
on
Pedro.
But the cemetery there, it has, from the 1870s, it has this husband and wife, and it has like a sculpture, these two stern-looking people. And the text on the stone is, "We surrender our molecules to the universe," like two atheists say, just really wanted to make a statement. You know, we give ourselves back to the universe to do what they want with us. And it's really impressive.
You know, I'll tell you about it.
There's a lot of atheism in this town, too.
Yeah.
That's one of the streaks.
Wow.
And the song Louie Louie, the Kingsman version, was recorded in a building in downtown Portland that is now office of the Atheist Foundation of Portland.
Wow.
Same building.
It's supposedly one of the fastest growing religions.
Yeah.
But a twofer grave on Long Island.
Yeah.
When I turned 40, I found out John Coltrane is in Pine Lawn. I took the train from under Madison Square Garden, Penn Station.
Right.
There's a Long Island Railroad. It stops at Pylon.
Right.
And there are the boneyards right there.
Well, there's...
I thought it was going to work.
When he died, he was living in Dix Hills, which is next to Huntington, in Suffolk County, where Whitman lived for a while, too. And Blue Oyster Cult, when they were this soft white underbelly, for 10 minutes they lived in Dix Hills, probably at the time when Coltrane was still alive.
Yeah, because he died in 67.
Yeah.
So I go, first time I couldn't, there's 10,000 graves I couldn't find.
Right.
So I go back another time, I take the train about 4 days later, and he's in the Garden of the Sanctuary, and it was a twofer. So John W. Coltrane, and the other one was empty. And he died at 40, so I was 40.
Right.
I laid there. I don't know if this is bad to do, but I laid right on top.
Yeah.
Face up.
Yeah. Joe Scott for your pillow.
You know about them Asia rock pillows?
Yeah.
My friend, Uncle Son, her grandma used rock pillow. But anyway, I'm sitting over John Coltrane, and I'm thinking, John Coltrane, when you made an album, were you thinking of the single?
Right.
Wanted me to think about it.
Right.
But then he did those ballads things with Johnny Hartman. And
yeah, I think that was Bob Fields' idea.
Because there's also like an Ascension excerpt on a 7-inch.
Well, but the thing with Bob Field, who he was a producer at Impulse Records, he also produced one of the Jack Kerouac spoken word records. And he's the only producer who every single album he ever produced, he has his own picture on it. You know, it was Bob with John, and I think that he talked after Coltrane did those Village Vanguard LPs. You know, the session, the album Impressions, and also live at the Live at the Village Vanguard, I guess.
Vanguard.
And later it came out, it's like a 4-CD set.
All of it.
With Dolphy.
Yeah.
And that to me was his high water mark in terms of being allowed to get away with what he wanted to do with the record company. And after that, Bob Thiel pulled in the reins.
Oh.
And that's how they got to...
But after Steph and Alston, crazy stuff comes out.
But it was really like, I think that Bob Thiel got scared. That's okay. Far enough.
Yeah, far enough.
Yeah, but that was.
Did you ever get to go to the church at St. John Coltrane in San Francisco?
No.
At that Franzo, Archbishop Franzo.
Huh.
He's got a tenor Sunday trip during a conch shell, blows it, and, you know, lines a little bit for half an hour. Yeah. I took my organ player, Pete Mazich, and he comes up, he's in the frock, you know, we're going to work. And he's big jam on Coltrane for 3 hours. Now they're in Hunter's Point.
Yeah.
They were like, renting out a Lutheran.
There used to be a Church of Elvis here in Portland. There was this guy, a street guy, called himself Elvis for a while.
Well, they had some icons and John, a picture of John Coltrane's horn with fire came up, but I don't think they're praying to him. He's more like some messenger.
Right.
And there wasn't much gospel. At the end, it was stuff, you know, get together a little bit, but mainly it was like getting into his music.
Right. But he was somebody who, he after a certain point, he was constantly recording. I mean, in his own name. But he did so much work, like Prestige Records. He was on so many sessions.
Tuba players, bone players.
Yeah, Ray.
Even Baker, some Burrell, some guitar.
Yeah, and
but those are bad years. Those are junkie years, I think.
Right.
But towards the end, he's recording like crazy, too, where the song titles have numbers.
Right. But it was also, of all the really, really great jazz players, he was the latest bloomer. Of all the ones who finally showed what they had, he was in his 30s.
It's 10 years.
Yeah.
The last 10.
Right. You know, like...
Because he kind of cuts his thing on R&B and stuff.
Right.
The clean head guy.
Clean head Vincent.
Right. And he's playing alto.
Played Earl Bostick, who did.
Earl Bostick.
He did, what was it? Harlem Nocturne.
Look at this. Walk in the Bar. One of those books I have said Coltrane walked the fucking bar.
Right.
I can't.
Yeah. Okay.
Work the room.
Yeah. Right.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for...
We're at the time. I got to get off the phone.
Seattle.
Crocodile.
Oh, yeah.
They call it Belltown.
I did a reading there once, Crocodile. Yeah. I opened for Cat Power.
Sure.
She used to live here.
I saw her. We played with her the day all the Stooges shit was stolen.
Uh-huh.
The next night. Jim White was her drummer.
Yeah. She's become a strange,
I think she's living in Cali.
Yeah.
So.
But she lived.
She sang great. She had the cat from John Spencer on guitar, Judah, and Jim White on the drum.
Yeah.
Not shy.
Right.
No more.
She's
still with that voice.
Still is that neurotic stage act where it's, I don't know if I can play this song, but let's see.
No. She's.
Yeah.
I mean, ain't Madonna, but she's.
Right.
But thanks for being on the show, man. It's a true honor for me.
Oh,
and good luck with the book, man. I can't wait.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Spielgusher
soon.
Yeah.
We're mixing it now.
Great.
This is 50. Well, actually 63 altogether, but 50 where I actually 50 get to
years
music.
In the making.
10 of them we're going to be with the Minuteman, right?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
I gave D. Boone the words on that last ride he took. I started this tour on that road.
Mm.
His pop showed me the pictures, wanted to give them to me. I didn't take them, but by looking at them, I know where it is, kind of, and I passed it.
Mm.
I didn't want to keep them. He gave me two of his guitars, though. So this whole third opera, I wrote, I can't play guitar very well, but I thought I just want to write all the songs, none on bass.
Yeah.
Write on one of his guitars.
That's terrific. Yeah.
Much respect.
You're one of the great sentimental slobs that I know. I'm one too, so.
Yeah, I can't let go. But I push forward on in some ways.
You certainly do.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Yeah.